She came and knelt before him and said, "Lord, help me." He answered, "It is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." One of the joys of reading the Gospels is to see Jesus in operation with all sorts of different people. Jesus, after all, is Emmanuel, God with us. And so to watch Jesus is to get an idea of how God operates. And in most encounters, Jesus is warm and witty. Think of his give and take with the tax collector Zacchaeus that we considered last week. Or his banter with the woman from Samaria at the well told in John 4. Or his conversations with the blind man in John 9. In these encounters, Jesus is the manifestation of God's grace. He surprises us in delightful ways. He overturns convention. He makes unloved and unappreciated people feel the love of God. That's the Jesus we know and love. That's the Jesus who is God with us and God for us. There's another side to Jesus as well. It's Jesus in the encounter with the Pharisees and the religious leaders. So witty Jesus, it's a oft-times sarcastic Jesus. A get in an argument with me and I will make you look like a fool Jesus. We like this Jesus too. In large part because we don't like the Pharisees or the stuffed-shirt religious leaders. They ought to be put in their place. And Jesus does it neatly, with just the right amount of snark and bite. And the Pharisees crawl off, licking their wounds, and we think, way to go, Jesus. In our passage for today, it's like the two sides of Jesus get mixed up. And we recoil from the sour aftertaste it leaves. Usually when Jesus says something hurtful or cutting, he says it to someone whose inflated sense of their own holiness or importance needs desperately to be pricked and deflated. So when Jesus calls the Pharisees whitewashed tombstones or broods of vipers, well, it takes them down a notch or two. They had it coming. But today, why did Jesus choose today, of all days, to be biting and sarcastic? Why did Jesus pick today to utter a reprehensible ethnic slur? The person involved is a Canaanite woman, the classic outsider to Jewish society. She's in her home territory. The region of Tyre and Sidon was Canaanite land. Historically, she was the sort of person who in the Gospels we've come to identify sympathetically. She's like a leper or a social outcast. And the empathy runs deep. Not only is she a social outcast, but she has a daughter who is tormented by a demon. And it is on her daughter's behalf that she approaches Jesus. It is out of love for her daughter that she risks public humiliation in a cry for help. "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon." And Jesus responds, well, pick your poison. Is it better that Jesus first ignores her, acts like she doesn't exist? Acts as if she wasn't there, wasn't crying at the top of her lungs, wasn't making a public spectacle of herself, wasn't embarrassing Jesus' disciples half to death, so that they had to tug on Jesus' sleeve and urge him, "Get her out of here." So Jesus, act as if she doesn't exist. I mean, think of the deference that she had shown Jesus, the faith present in her initial cry, "Lord, Son of David." Although she is Canaanite, she acknowledges Jesus is from God. In fact, in her crying out, she is invoking the powers of heaven and hell. It is heaven that Jesus represents to her. It is hell that has a hold on her daughter. And in her cry for mercy, she simply asks Jesus to be on the side of the angels. And in return, what does she get in the first place? She gets silence. Silence. And while the silent Jesus who ignores her is bad enough, and let me just speak here for myself, I much prefer the silent Jesus to the Jesus who opens his mouth a few moments later, only to utter words of ethnic exclusion and ultimately couch that exclusion in the form of an ethnic slur. When Jesus finally stirs to speech, he continues to ignore her. He speaks to his disciples, assuring them there's no reason to respond to her pleas. She's not an Israelite. So what is this woman and her daughter to him and his mission? And when the woman comes and kneels before Jesus, forcing her presence into his sight and making Jesus notice her and respond to her, it only gets worse. The simplest of requests, Lord, help me, her first cry, was Kyrie eleison, the cry of the faithful through the ages. Lord, have mercy. And when she kneels before Jesus, it becomes the cry of Psalm 70, a cry that has signaled the opening of worship in monastic traditions down through the ages. Lord, come to my assistance. O God, make haste to help me. She's speaking the language that Christians down through the ages have spoken in supplication to God. Lord, help me. And the response, it's not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. Why did you say it, Jesus? Why? To compare someone to a dog is rarely a good thing, but in Middle Eastern culture, dogs are highly despised. It was certainly so in biblical times. I challenge anyone to find a single positive reference to a dog in the Old or New Testament. And even today in the Middle East, dogs are detested and feared. It is why dogs played such a prominent role in the interrogation and torture of prisoners in Iraq and at Guantanamo Bay. Dogs are detestable in Middle Eastern society, and it was the worst sort of reference on Jesus' part to make an analogy between the woman and a dog. What are we going to do? Within the Christian tradition, there have been various ways in which attempts have been made to soften the harshness of Jesus' words. One of the most common is to invoke the omniscience of Jesus. Jesus is all-knowing, not of everything just now, but of what is to come. So it's okay. Jesus knew what was going to happen. He knew it was going to turn out all right. And so his silence and his harsh reply are merely a test of faith of the woman. Frederick Dale Bruner, who has written what is probably the best commentary on the Gospel of Matthew, detests this argument. He notes that it allows Jesus to be the hypocrite that he so railed against, and it plays on the prejudices of the disciples. A second way to soften these words is to invoke the theology of the Gospel of Matthew. Among the four Gospels, the Gospel of Matthew has a thread that portrays Jesus' mission during his lifetime as being only to the Jews. That's the way it will continue throughout Jesus' ministry, and only when Jesus is ultimately rejected on the cross does the resurrection open the door to Gentiles as well. So in this interpretation, Jesus is laser-focused on his mission to Israel, to the Jews. And what we find are only occasional hints that Jesus' mission will ultimately widen, open up, and include the Gentiles. And we get hints of this. In fact, there are various points in the Gospel of Matthew where Gentiles make an appearance. The Magi in Matthew 2. This woman here. A band of Gentiles who show up in the temple just before Jesus' death. These episodes hint in the Gospel of Matthew at a widening of Jesus' mission that is to come. Theologians even have a pedantic term they apply to this. It's adumbration. It's a hint of what is to come once the resurrection has taken place. It adumbrates what is to come. But while that may account and give a rationale for why Jesus resists helping the woman and her daughter, it doesn't explain the harshness. Because in a moment of encounter with Jesus, does omniscience excuse insensitivity? Does the theological agenda obliterate the need for grace and mercy, or a duty to avoid belittlement? Does divinity excuse parsimony, tight-fistedness, when it comes to the grace of God? And so we are left grasping how to handle this story, an awkward story, without turning the Canaanite woman into a mere object lesson or some kind of unimportant foil for Jesus. How to keep her humanity? I used to think I knew what to do with this passage. When I come back to it, I don't know. It's a head scratcher. And more than that, it's a soul twister. Perhaps we make a mistake when we make this story primarily about Jesus. Don't get me wrong, Jesus is in the story, and Jesus is ultimately the one who heals. But I don't think this story is in the first place about Jesus. I think rather than a Canaanite woman's encounter with Jesus, this is about Jesus' encounter with a Canaanite woman. She is the heroine of the story. She eclipses everyone else in the story, including Jesus. I'm just going to say it out loud. I like her better than Jesus in this story. But maybe we can find a cue from someone for whom, I find this hard to say, was the favorite story in all the Gospels. Can you imagine that? This story being the favorite among all the Gospel stories? You know who loved this story above all else? It was Martin Luther, the great reformer and theologian of the 16th century. The monk who wrestled with God for years, certain that God was rejecting him as unworthy, who felt that every time he neared the confessional to confess his sins, God would refuse absolution and forgiveness. Because Martin Luther was a dog who did not deserve to eat at the master's table, who did not deserve God's grace. Why did Luther love this story so much? Because an uneducated pagan woman went toe-to-toe with the Son of God, laid claim to God's grace, persisted even in the face of silence and then insult, until even Jesus had to acknowledge he was licked and had to commend her for her persistent grasping at God's love. Because Jesus, who in arguments with the best male Jewish legal minds of his day, consistently mic-dropped his opponents, found his match in a woman whose sole motivation was to win a reprieve for her tormented child. It made Martin Luther hopeful that even such a dog as himself could lay claim to God's grace. Turn in the back of your bulletins a minute to the work of art that's there. This is from an illuminated manuscript of the 1400s. And I have to say, I'm not a huge fan of this art period. The paintings tend to be a little stilted. I always find it a little odd that it's depicted as if it happens in the Middle Ages. There's a castle on the hill. Everybody's dressed as a person in the 14th century would. And the scene is split. The top part has Jesus with his back turned to the woman. She's imploring, but he doesn't pay her attention. You can see off in the corner the sick daughter in a little shed. And at the bottom, she's finally gotten Jesus' attention and she's kneeling. But the thing about this painting, this manuscript, it's the pathway. What's on the pathway? We know what's on the pathway. It's stones, right? Are those stones? I think they're crumbs. Where if you take a loaf of bread and pull a piece off, it's got that odd shape to it. And I think the pathway is lined with crumbs. Because you see, ultimately, this story is about crumbs. And it makes me marvel what sort of wisdom and faith the woman had to know that sometimes crumbs are more than enough. Now, if there's one thing I would like to add to her response, it would be an affirmation of herself and her personhood. Don't get me wrong, I love her response. I mean, Jesus loved her response, why shouldn't we? But I do wish that before she made her telling comment about the crumbs, that she had prefaced it by saying this to Jesus: "Lord, I have seen dogs, I have known dogs, and I, sir, am not a dog. But even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table." So if someday biblical scholars come across an ancient manuscript that has that in there, it would be most excellent. So what can we take from this passage beyond the notion that even when we're feeling very much like a dog, we still have access to God's grace? Well, let me just mention two things quickly. One, we shouldn't lose sight of what it is that motivated this woman and made her risk humiliation in front of Jesus and the disciples. The purest motivations that we have are motivations of love. It is love that is most likely to make us forget ourselves, to give up our fixation on ourselves, our incessant preoccupation with ourselves. For when we commit our affections to someone else, when we become bound to them in love, we transcend ourselves. And we find ourselves doing things and pleading with a strength that's greater than our own. What drove this woman was her overwhelming love for her daughter. And grace is a fitting gift for those who love. So like this woman, don't hesitate to give yourself to love. And we should notice that Jesus doesn't begrudge grace when left no choice. One of the strengths of the theology of Matthew interpretation, that Jesus first had to explore the full dimension of God's covenant with the Jews before things could open up fully to the Gentiles. One of the benefits of that interpretation is that Jesus does know what is coming, and we should note his reaction on those occasions when his full mission is laid bare. He does not begrudge it. Who would know better that God's grace knows no bounds, can't be kept in containers, can't be denied to anyone? Never begrudge grace. Jesus certainly doesn't. And what we find bound up in the woman's response, crumbs from the master's table, was an understanding of who Jesus was and what God was doing and the power of God's grace. Yeah, it was a faith born out of desperation, but it also was born out of a vision of what God is doing and how God does it. This woman saw with eyes of faith, with clarity. And this woman knew that the overflowing goodness of God's salvation simply couldn't be contained and limited to Israel alone. It may be that at this time, according to the Gospel of Matthew, God's plan is particularized, is aimed towards Israel. But she recognized that its greatness and goodness inevitably spills out over onto others. Like a super saturated cloth or sponge that just drips with God's goodness, or to keep the bread metaphor, like cutting a good loaf of hard crusted homemade bread and a shower of crumbs cascades onto the floor. And those crumbs were enough for her and her daughter. My son, Jalen, has a dog. Reggie's a cute little pomapoo, far too cute for his own good. And Jalen will bring Reggie over to our house. And Reggie comes bounding in the house, and he has to say hello to his peeps when he gets there. He says hi, and then he spends the next 5 minutes scouring the kitchen floor. Reggie is a metaphor for how to view God's grace. And you know, it's also a reminder that sometimes crumbs are enough.